You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's bring him out. Here's your favorite, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Come on out, boys.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, July 18th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Viva Las Vegas.
But you know, for a while now, many of you have noticed that there's just been four of us on the show. Some have set a hole, or at least room to expand our awesomeness, is how I like to think about it. So we do have an announcement to make. We have added our fifth permanent rogue to the SGU. And we are going to reveal them to you live here on stage at TAM 13. Now, to honor James Randi, we're going to do the reveal as a magic trick. Gentlemen, if you will.
Super.
For those of you who don't recognize this awesome skeptic and science communicator to my right, this is Kara Santa Maria. Kara, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, everyone.
So a lot of people pointed out that the SGU could stand a little bit more diversity on the panel, which we agree with. So we decided that we really had to get somebody with tattoos. And so we now have covered the tattoo contingent. We're all set to go. Kara, tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
First of all, I have to say that I am thrilled, I'm honored, I'm just over the moon and really emotional about this exciting opportunity. I'm so happy that the reveal got to happen right here in front of all of you, my friends, the skeptic community. Hi, I'm Kara. I am now the fifth rogue. That's something about me. I also host another podcast called Talk Nerdy, and I work full-time. Oh, thanks. I work full-time as a freelance science communicator, trying to kind of translate science to the public across a lot of different media platforms, television, the web, podcasting, any place I can.
Any place you can. Yeah. And you're doing a great job.
We were actually, thank you so much.
So we've conducted an exhaustive search. It really is true. We spent, 6 months really carefully considering all of our options. And we had Kara on for a stealth interview earlier in the year. We had her on as a guest rogue, if you recall. It was in January, right?
Yep.
But we didn't tell her that she was on our short list, for the permanent position. But the chemistry was, I think, pretty instantaneous. Like,
really?
We knew that, yep, which basically means that she could keep up with us. Right?
No, it means you guys could keep up with me.
Yeah. Right. That's what I meant. Right. So we do have a great show for you. We're going to go ahead and go right to our show. I had to show this picture. So this is in this casino. We were walking through this casino. I saw this this sign which says Las Vegas, a review journal poll, voted best paying slots.
What's wrong with this picture?
What's the keyword?
Yeah.
What's the keyword there?
Yeah, so voted?
Voted. Like, what does that mean?
So
voted?
Yeah, what are they claiming? Forget about who voted. What are they?
The custodial staff? Yeah, who voted?
Now, we don't have the best paying slot. But we were voted the best.
But who voted is important as well, because if it's like the people that work here,
it's the review journal poll. I'm assuming that.
So you don't think it was rigged?
Probably not. But it struck me as incredibly funny, that sort of subtle, not so subtle, deceptive advertising. Voted best paying slots. Okay. My daughter took a picture of this at the Portland Science Museum. And she had to text it to me right away because she knew that it would drive me crazy. You know, even in a science museum, regional political correctness asserts itself, apparently. So this is in the science museum. It says, are GMOs dangerous? Most scientists agree that the main safety issues of GMOs concern the environment. Really? I've never heard most scientists agree with that.
Yeah.
Insect evolution superweeds and transgene plants wiping out their wild relatives are all possibilities. So, and then it goes on in that vein. So they're really struggling. They're really struggling to make semi-reasonable scientific statements with, you know, just to, so they're not overtly anti-science, but they're also not going to rub the local population that may, you know, where anti-GMO sentiments predominate the wrong way. So it really, but, you know, science museum should have more balls, I would think, to just say it like it is rather than pandering, which, wouldn't you agree, this is a bit of pandering?
And where, which museum was this in?
In Portland, Oregon.
That's, never mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so the obvious statement is they're riding the fence because, you know, thousands of people are moving through the museum and they don't want to just come out and say, sorry, you know, something you may believe is actually wrong and the science museum is going to tell you it's wrong. Isn't that the point?
It's actually misinforming the public because, like, insect evolution, superweeds, and displacing local plants has nothing to do with GM. That's what happens when you have massive farming, right? Now, it's all about how the technology is being used. Also, the superweeds is not a scientific concept. What makes a weed a superweed?
Well, you know, when you get high after one toke, that's superweed.
All right.
Okay.
That aside.
Steve, what did they say about evolution at that museum? Did they pander to other groups?
All I know is what I'm seeing on the picture my daughter sent me. But superweeds are weeds that are resistant to herbicides. Okay, yeah, if we overuse herbicides, they're going to, that's like some bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. That makes them super bacteria. But the implication is like there's something especially dangerous about these super weeds, other than the fact that they're resistant to a particular herbicide. But they're just weeds who now are going to, you know, you can't control with this particular herbicide, but it's all scare tactics.
And of course, herbicides are used in organic farming also.
Yes,
all farming uses herbicides. So
you have to.
I guess we should all be scared of superweeds across farmland in America.
Yeah, or you hand pull the weeds up, you know, which actually is bad for the environment because it releases a lot of CO2 into the environment. And it's also not that practical if you're doing enough farming to feed
several million
people.
I didn't know it released CO2 into the environment.
Yeah. So the best tilling and disturbing the soil.
So the best way is chemical?
Well, it's, you know, you want to use what's called integrated pest management, which is using a variety of methods that are optimized for the local environment and what you're growing, et cetera, so that you're trying to minimize the downside of any one particular strategy. Because if you over-rely on any one thing, then that whatever that thing is, things will evolve around it. That's just evolution. That's
so
like
more
using one antibiotic over and over again. Yeah, everything's going to get resistant.
Yeah, but nobody's going to claim that we shouldn't take antibiotics
right.
if we get sick. I mean, antibiotics have completely changed healthcare across the world. Well, so it's a problem that we need to mitigate, but it's definitely not something that should make us, you know, just nix this technology altogether. That's insane.
Right.
The more strategies, the better, isn't that pretty much the bottom line?
I agree with that. Okay, Bob, you're going to do your forgotten superhero of science.
Henrietta Leavitt.
Bob, talking to the mic.
Uh-huh. Running gag on our show.
Should have seen that coming. Henrietta Swan Leavitt, 1868 to 1921. She was an astronomer who was the first person to have a key insight into the creation of the first standard candle of astronomy that essentially opened up the universe to us. It made us appreciate at least a better approximation of the scale of the universe and the distance to very remote galaxies, which we were not able to do before her work. Now, Leavitt investigated a lot of variable stars in the Magellanic Clouds, about, I think, 1,700 stars. She found 47 of them that were Cepheid variables. That's a very special class of variable star. They pulsate. They have a period where they pulsate, increasing their diameter and their luminosity over a period of time. Now, she was looking at their light curves, and she had this incredible insight. She realized that there was a direct relationship between the period of the pulsation and the luminosity of that star. This is the period-luminosity relationship. Now, this is what helped establish the standard candle. So this is how it works. You're looking at a star. You know what the period is. You can follow the light curve. You can see it getting brighter and then dimmer. But we have no idea how far away that is. But if you know the period, that means you can determine what the magnitude, the absolute magnitude of that star, the intrinsic magnitude, if you were really close to it.
But you know how bright it is.
Right.
You know how bright it looks. You can calculate how far away it is.
Exactly. So you look, you see how dim it is. You see how bright it should be if you were really close. And from there, it's a simple step to figure out exactly how far away it is. Now, that one insight led to a host of amazing discoveries. We learned the size and the shape of the Milky Way. We learned that spiral nebulae were actually, like Andromeda, were actually not in the Milky Way, but were galaxies in their own rights, millions, many millions of light years away. Also, Edwin Hubble, you know, he's that guy that the telescope is named after. He actually used her insight and some others to actually determine that the universe is expanding. I mean, pretty amazing stuff. So, remember Henrietta Leavitt. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when you're discussing the Kappa mechanism and non-adiabatic stellar pulsation.
That just came up the other day.
Yeah, it did.
Over drinks.
It happens.
So what do you guys think is turning into the biggest science news story?
Pluto, come on, Pluto.
Pluto.
I love Disney films.
It's turning into a much bigger story than I thought. Our best image of Pluto as of 1996 was essentially a very few number of pixels, essentially an amorphous blob of light. That was the cutting edge of our image, our knowledge about Pluto up until very recently. Even as late as 2005, you know, we could see Pluto, its big moon Charon, and its smaller moons, but we couldn't really see any details on the surface. Then New Horizons arrived at Pluto, and we started getting awesome pictures. So this is actually a picture of Pluto taken before the probe stopped sending us pictures so that it could focus on its close approach. So this is not close approach. This is just fairly close. And you could see, we could actually see a world. You know, you could see details. You know, it doesn't look like a blob of light or pixels. It looks like a world. Now, are you guys ready for close approach to Pluto? Now, we could see flat surfaces. You could see mountains. You could see incredible detail. We're starting to get data. It's going to take, as we said previously, 26 months to get all the data back that it gathered as it whizzed by Pluto, but every day we're getting more images, and this is like the first one that NASA produced is super close.
Now, the key thing here, Steve, I think, is that this is really evidence of geology that is not 100 million years old. The plains there are like 100 million years old.
Yes, so if you see the flat, bright area on Pluto that's not cratered, that means that that's recent, and the astronomers estimate that that area is no more than 100 million years old. That means Pluto is geologically active.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah, that's awesome. So this is Pluto's moon Charon, which I had. This is super close. This, again, was just a pixel of light until very recently. Again, now it looks like a world. I had to show this because you see the dark region at the top of the planet? It's dark. It has that kind of squared off U shape. It is amazing that that looks exactly like Mordor from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Right? And guess what astronomers are calling that region of Charon?
The Hobbit. It's Hobbiton, right?
The dark splotch.
They're calling it Mordor.
Yeah.
How great is that?
That is cool.
That is cool, proves that astronomers are nerds.
They didn't give it a number, a boring number designation? No. Awesome.
Freaking Mordor. I had to show that. That's awesome.
Real quick, how awesome is it that we're alive during a planet and a planet's moon discovery?
Yeah.
We could see the surface now. We couldn't see it a month ago. We're seeing it today. Yeah.
A dwarf planet,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Well,
let's be clear. A Kuiper's Belt object, actually.
It starts early.
Okay. But Jay,
is there anything else that I did wrong today?
Jay, don't forget, this isn't just Pluto. This is a region of our solar system that is unknown. We know it has never been visited. This is a milestone in this type of... this type of exploration.
So, people have pointed out that it's probable that this is the last time in our lifetimes that we will go from knowing almost nothing about a planetoid in our solar system to knowing a tremendous amount. The this rapid increase in knowledge, you know, about Pluto and its system, that's probably the last time this is going to happen in our lifetime. Maybe the youngest among us, you know, might experience it again. But yeah, we're pretty much done, except for the outer Kuiper Belt objects. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Jay. The European Union has some interesting ideas about space exploration. Give us up to date.
Well, the new Director General of the European Space Agency, who just started the beginning of July 2015, Professor Johann Dietrich Wöhner. Wöhner? Not bad. He was a former chair of the German Space Agency, which I think qualifies him for the job. And in his first week on the job, he said he wants to build a lunar village.
Village on the moon.
A village on the moon.
And who are they going to send up there? The village people.
That's a start.
Were they going to dance on the moon?
They're going to moonwalk on the
moon. Moonwalk, there you
obviously.
Go.
Obviously.
Oh, and...
Hey-o.
Let it go. Yeah. Okay, so right out of the gate, that might sound a little crazy. What do you mean you want to build a village on the moon? You're saying they should build it on the dark side of the moon. Which does make kind of sense because it's probably easier to maintain life because of the temperature.
There's no dark side of the moon. So you mean the far side of the moon?
No, the dark side of the moon. Like the album. You remember the album?
No, but seriously, there is.
He actually said that they. Dark side of the moon.
There is no dark side of the moon.
Of course there isn't.
All dark.
And the far side of it, I don't want to say the far side of the moon.
No, I know. The whole moon gets exposed to sunlight.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Well, for whatever he means, I don't know what the hell he means. I'm just reading what
the far
he said.
Side. It's the far side.
It's possible he means the far side because the moon's locked in orbit with the Earth. We see the same face of the moon at all times.
Well, then I don't agree with that because I want to be able to see the colony.
Well, not only that, but it's the far side of the moon gets all the meteors, right? Because it's facing away from the Earth.
But it also probably has, I guess, like less... tidal forces, you know, there's no water, but less kind of gravitational forces on it, which maybe, I don't know.
I don't know if that's an
I'm just making something up right now.
But isn't that where all the water is? Isn't that where all the water resources are?
The water is at the poles. And if that's what he means, that makes sense. You should build it at the poles because there are craters on the poles of the moon that never see sunlight. And there could be some frozen water there. So that's... That's maybe what he meant, but not they shouldn't use the term dark side because it creates misconception.
Okay.
All right.
We're out of time for this episode.
So, you know, thinking about this, I agree with a lot of things that he said, not that that matters, but you're saying that we could perform an enormous amount of science with a permanent station, permanently manned moon station. I don't know exactly what
Moon Base Alpha.
Moon Base Alpha. But another huge reason that he said was that this would be a good launching point for bigger space missions like Mars. And he actually said something along the lines of, you know, NASA wants to go to Mars. If they really want to do it, the way to do it is via the moon.
Yeah, so the gravity well is so much better for launching.
I agree with that. Asimov said that 30 years ago, and I agreed with it then, and I still agree with it. Let's flesh out the Earth-Moon system. And then go to Mars.
And then the idea that NASA also said that they were thinking about sending a 3D printer up there, right, to help
at
build
least one.
Tools and things that they need, which I thought was really cool. But he said, let's test all this on the moon. It's a much easier place to manage if there's an emergency or, hey, you know, that thing broke. We could, you know, it takes 4 days to get there.
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea. Now, here's a few stats that I found interesting. So... His budget as of 2015 is 4.4 billion euros, and that's pretty much equivalent to U.S. dollars at this point with the current exchange rate. That is not a lot of money, particularly when you compare it to the cost of the International Space Station, which was 150 billion, right? So, you know, on his yearly budget, he couldn't do it alone.
Well, I guess you got to start somewhere, but that is not nearly, I mean, we're talking so much more than that to actually
Absolutely, but he knows it would have to be an international effort.
Of course.
And he also thinks it's a very good idea that it is an international effort for several reasons. You know, he was saying we need to do these things internationally. We need to get the entire world, not just four or five nations, but the entire world.
That's going to cost trillions of dollars.
To fully produce, you know, a living atmosphere there. But you know what? Here's a question. When is the last time that we actually had a manned mission to the moon?
It was the end of the Apollo.
Yeah, it was what, in the 70s?
70s.
Early 70s.
70s.
That's sad, isn't it?
Very sad.
Well, Superman went there in 1979.
Okay. So about the same time.
And I think it was the second movie, right? Yeah, so 79.
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah,
that
we threw all our money into the space shuttle.
You know, had cause to go back.
It's probably because it's amazingly expensive.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah.
And there was a political reason, if you believe the history that we went in right now, it really would be simply just for science.
But it does seem like such a good idea. I mean, so many people are excited about Mars One. So many people are excited about these kind of pie in the sky, I think, movements to be able to go and terraform Mars. We're not ready to do that. This is definitely a kind of a way station on the way.
Yeah. I think, we need the technology that we would gain from doing this, and then it makes more sense.
We'll learn so much from just going to the moon first. I like how in this picture, though, there's a car with headlights sort of driving down the road. That's an interesting idea.
You'd have your own house.
That will ever happen. But
Ev, like that little Eskimo hut there is yours.
Oh, cool.
On the moon. Yeah. So a couple more things, guys. $2.9 billion to run the IIS. The ISS annually. Mm-hmm. It's a ton of money. And NASA's 2015 budget is $18 billion.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of money out there, but $18 billion, when you start adding up missions like this, is really not that much money.
Right. Plus, we have to get there, otherwise we're never going to discover the obelisk, right?
Yeah.
Or the monolith. Bob, you're going to tell us about fighting giant robots.
The United States has declared war on Japan. Not really a war, it's more of a challenge. And it's not people really fighting, it's giant robots. But how awesome is that? Now, this started, I'm sure a lot of you have heard of this. This started earlier this month. Megabots, Inc., from the United States, made a YouTube challenge to the Japanese company Tsudobashi Heavy Industry, which quickly went viral. And the CEO said in his YouTube video, "We have a giant robot. You have a giant robot. You know what needs to happen."
Of course.
"We challenge you to a duel. In 1 year, we fight." So the response came just a couple days later from Kogoro Kurata from Tsudobashi. He said, "Yeah, I'll fight, absolutely. We can't let another country win this. Giant robots are Japanese culture." Clearly. But his best line was, "Just building something huge and sticking guns on it, it's super American." He said, "We really need melee combat, and I can't disagree with that. I want to punch them to scrap and knock them down to do it." So it's on. It's totally on. It's on.
That was trash talk.
But I want to set expectations here. This image you're seeing on the screen, this is what we want to think when this is going to happen. It's not going to look like this. To be a little bit more realistic, think of this. Think of these Rock'em Sock'em robots.
I remember that.
Bob.
All right, that's a little bit closer to reality.
I had those.
Of course we did. I remember kicking your butt, Jay.
It'd be the red robot every time.
Yes. So let's take a look at what the real robots are going to look like. So you see here on the left, that is the Mark II. That is America's first fully functional giant piloted robot. I've always wanted to say that.
Look at all those spectators standing around. Imagine a bad scenario there. It's gone mad. Everyone run.
I wish I were there. So it's 6 tons, 15 feet tall. It's controlled by 2 pilots.
Are they neurally connected to it?
Not yet. That's the Mark V. This is the Mark II.
Are they in there? Or are they?
This robot can shoot 3-pound paint cannonballs. I mean, who's played paintball? They're little things. This is a 3-pound, and it could shoot it at 100 miles an hour, which is 160 kilometers per hour. And I've seen that thing in action. That puts a serious dent in the car. I mean, that's a pretty powerful, lots of kinetic energy.
Bob,
yes.
Is that a guy I see in it? They're in a cockpit?
Yes. Yep, there's 2 guys in that one on the left. So that's the Mark II on your left. On the right is the Kuratas. It's a little bit smaller, a little bit lighter, only 13 feet tall. There's a single pilot, and it's commercially available. This thing has been on the market for a few years.
So ours is
bigger than ours.
Ours is bigger, ours is heavier, but
who has purchased this thing? Who has that in their backyard?
Evil scientists. to protect their island lair.
If I had the money, I would so buy it. Come on.
So Bob. Yes. Yeah, Bob's the evil scientist at the table.
But this guy, the Kuratas, is cool. This guy has twin non-lethal Gatling guns. I think it shoots BBs. It has a hyper-advanced targeting system, whatever that means, and it's got a heads-up display, which is really cool. The goal, though, is interesting. Megabot's goal is not just this battle. This is just a preliminary thing. What they want to do is create a billion-dollar sports league where giant robots battle each other. This is their end game. They're doing this just to generate interest and to raise money. They tried Kickstarter. There wasn't enough interest, so they latched onto this idea, and I think it's a really cool idea. So the plan is for June 2016, Megabots would love to have it on an aircraft carrier in international waters, which I think is an awesome idea. But predictions. All right, now we've got a year for upgrades, so who knows what could happen in a year. But the Mark II, the United States robot, I mean, it doesn't really even have arms. Those are just like weapon platforms, and if they're not going to be using those, then they need to do a lot of work. And I think the Karatas, just look at it. There's no rust. It's been around for years, and the arms are actually seem like arms that could possibly do some sort of melee combat. So right now, my prediction, based on how they are right now, is going to go for Japan, I believe.
I don't know about it. I'm worried because one of these could accidentally become sentient during the fight and kill everyone. Like, this is not cool.
They're already sentient. There's people inside, so.
isn't there one on the right... from that movie Chappie? Doesn't it look like that?
I just saw Chappie. That was not in the movie.
One on the left is shooting paint, you just shoot the paint into the windshield with the Japanese robot, and the guy's not going to be able to see where the heck he's going.
No projectile.
And you do a flanking maneuver, game over.
It's going to be all melee. It's all hand-to-hand. Robot arm to robot arm.
Okay. Oh, so they might even tip. They might knock each other over.
Of course.
For real.
Japan is saying they want to pound it to scrap, so yeah, okay. You might see some of that.
Wait, it's all hand-to-hand, then why is he shooting paintball?
Yeah, that's how it is right now.
And
that's what the Mark II wanted to do, but Japan said, no, that's too American. Let's just do melee combat.
So that's it. Gotcha.
Okay, move on. So Kara, your first news item.
I know, and I picked one that's really exciting. It's very happy.
Well, tell us about
it. It's very upbeat, you know. Look at the wonderful stock photography model there. I love it when you see stories about depression online because they always pick these like sad stock photography models. But I wanted to talk a little bit about depression. It's something that's near and dear to my heart. It's something that I talk about quite often because I deal with depression. I take medication for it. I see a therapist for it. And there's a new study actually just published this week in the Journal of Medical Internet Research. I love that that's a journal. That's so great. And what they found in this study is that there's a chance that your smartphone might be able to actually diagnose you, might be able to actually help with some treatment options, because there's a very preliminary study that was done here at Northwestern at the Behavioral Intervention, the Center for Behavioral Intervention Technologies by David Moore, and kind of an ingenious idea. He was like, okay, we're all connected to our smartphones, and our smartphones have tons of sensors, like up to 40 sensors in them now. What if we use that data to try and understand behavioral patterns and see if we could correlate those behavioral patterns with, you know, certain psychiatric symptoms? So it's a very small preliminary study, only 28 participants. There's still a lot of work to be done to make sure that it's validated. But what they found is that they could predict with up to 87% accuracy individuals who rated high on a questionnaire of depressive kind of traits, they could predict it just by looking at smartphone data. They gave them an app that looked at two really salient features. The first one was, how often is the screen on? How often are you spending time on your phone? And the next one was, how mobile are you? You know, all of our phones are equipped with a GPS, and they found that individuals who tended to stay home significantly more often than the other group, individuals that tended to stay on their phones with the screens on significantly more often, and also individuals who kept a more erratic schedule, like they didn't go to work at the same time every day, they didn't wake up or go to sleep at the same time every day, had high levels of correlation with these depressive symptoms. Wow. So they were able to do it by looking at the data blind and saying, I would guess that that person rated high, that person rated low. 87% accuracy.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's
impressive.
I find this most interesting because of the app idea, this idea that our phones are collecting potentially tremendous amounts of data about this, about us, and this is only going to get more. You know, imagine, you know, in 10 or 20 or 30 years how big data is going to completely know everything about us. You know, of course, we could use it clinically to our benefit, But it's also a scary
It's also a bit scary, for sure. There's a really, really great documentary by Cullen Hoback, I think, called Terms and Conditions May Apply. And that's really what it's about, is you clicking that I agree button and basically uploading your entire life to a large corporation that they can use at will for all of the different market research.
I do, but I don't.
No, it's pretty crazy. And there's so many sensors. I just bought this iPad yesterday. It has a barometer in it.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Why do I need a barometer in my iPad?
It can warn you that you're about to get a migraine.
Yeah, it's so weird. it's like a therapy dog.
But, you know, think about...
You don't have to feed it.
The idea that it's going to be capturing, or the future phones are going to have the ability to capture biology. Like, you know, my wife and I just got the smartwatch, you know, the Fit thing, whatever, and it's monitoring my sleep and my heart rate and all that. And as this technology snowballs, you just got to imagine that everything about you is going to go onto the web.
Which, I mean, in some ways is so great, because now we can be using this data kind of prophylactically. We can be using it in a preventive way instead of, you know, this has existed for a long time, different kinds of electronic monitors for people who have had heart attacks, for example.
Yeah.
And then they wear these monitors at home. But usually that's once it's kind of too late.
Yeah.
That's during the treatment process. So the fact that, you know, young, healthy people can be monitoring themselves throughout their lifetime and say, oh, did you see that weird blip?
Yeah.
That's, maybe I should go get that checked out.
Like, that would be great. Like, your doctor looks over, like, let me look at the graph chart of you this past year for your yearly physical.
All right, but let me tell you the downside of that.
Go ahead.
Right? Because whenever we do that in medicine, we gather tons of information. At first, what we find is that it actually makes us overdiagnose stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then it could actually have a net negative effect. In fact, just to give you one example, for a time, you know, fetal monitoring was in vogue, right? So, yeah, put those monitors on in the labor period, gather information about the, you know, the heart rate of the baby. And then they did studies, and they found that when they did that, that they were false positive alarms were resulting in unnecessary C-sections. And that, so they stopped doing it because they were gathering more data than they needed, and the false positives was making them overreact.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, why don't you just not do the C-sections? But it's kind of hard to stand there and watch the heart rate go down and not do something. So maybe we should just not look, you know, which is an interesting solution. So I think that, of course, the possibilities are tremendous, but I also see, imagine hypochondriacs, I mean, obsessing about the tiny fluctuations in their blood pressure or their pulse rate or whatever.
Sure, but Steve, we can't, I know that you're not saying this, but my first response to what you said is, tough shit, sorry, because there's a lot of other people.
But you have to consider the net health effects. You're trying to make the public healthier. You're proposing this as a public health intervention. And when you do that, you have to consider the downside.
I'm not saying don't consider it, because don't touch me, okay?
Public health considering, you know, effects, the net effects could actually be negative.
And here you're talking about really kind of more hard physiological data.
Yeah.
You know, this study is talking about behavioral data, which I think can be interpreted in even more loose ways. For example, one of the things they were looking at was the actual physical time that the screen is on your phone. Well, how many of us have jobs that require us to constantly be on our phones?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that I'm suffering from a clinical, you know, situation, or am I just at work? Like, that's a big thing. And they'll have to be able to come up with more and more robust algorithms for analyzing this data.
Yeah, it's a brave new world. But I think I'm not a Luddite. I'm in favor of it. I think it's going to be great. But we have to go in with our eyes wide open and just learn from our past experiences. More data isn't always better. It all depends on how you use it.
Yeah, which is why we should all be reading the Journal of Medical Internet Research.
Yes, absolutely. Let's move on a little bit. So science education is near and dear to all of our hearts, and we talk about this frequently on the show. There's been a spate of editorials by the Nature Publishing Group, which includes Scientific American, talking about teaching in general, teaching science specifically, and also maintaining STEM teaching, so, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, because, you know, we it's obviously very important for our future. And essentially, the consensus of these editorials is that we're doing it wrong. You know, we're teaching science wrong. And we know that because we've been researching it. There's a science of how to teach. There's a science of how to teach science. And essentially what they're saying is we need to bring our current teaching methods up to date with the science of teaching, which is
it's crazy talk.
It's crazy. It's something I've been saying for a while. It's like, yeah, you know, we need evidence-based teaching, you know, essentially. So the big focus is on what's called active learning. So rather than passive learning is like you're sitting in the audience and we're lecturing to you, right? So there's a role for that, but there's limits to how much you can transmit information in this passive lecturing mode. Then the evidence shows that students learn more and do better if you engage them in an active learning process. So for example, one program that's teaching virology, actually they start the semester by giving the students a simulation of a viral outbreak. And then over the course of their semester learning about virology, they have to apply what they're learning to study this virtual outbreak, intervene, you know, save lives, figure out what's going on, and then learn from what they do. And that was much more engaging. It was fun, you know, and so they learned a lot more. For example, studies show that the failure rate is reduced by 20% when you incorporate active learning, and that decreased by a third, and that 20% better grades in courses that incorporate active learning. Although those are relative outcome measures, I would have preferred outcome measures that were like they performed better on some objective measure, not that just they pass the course more or get better grades, because that's like, oh, yeah, we're going to give you better grades because we're giving you active learning. But anyway, the challenges, of course, is not just paying lip service to this as a concept, but doing it well, doing active learning well. Clarissa Dirks, who is the co-chair of U.S. National Academies of Science Teaching Alliance, said, at this point, it is unethical to teach any other way. So those are pretty strong words.
Wow.
But
wow.
She thinks that the evidence is such that if you're not incorporating active learning, it's so unscientific, it's actually unethical at this point. Here's a slide showing some statistics on students who enter college-level STEM courses, STEM programs. Only overall, 41% actually graduate from their STEM programs. That's a pretty poor retention rate. You know, about half of those who leave go to another field, and the other half just leave without a degree. And you see there's a breakdown by subspecialty. Engineering has the best retention. Computer science is at the lowest retention, but on average, it's about 41%. Those retention is worse for women and minorities, so that's a problem as well. One of the hopes is that incorporating active learning programs will improve retention, you know, because it'll make it more accessible. And there's a couple of interesting ideas came up when I was reading all the editorials about this. One is that as we move more to online learning, students could go online and watch a YouTube video or whatever where they have a world-class lecturer give the definitive didactic lecture about whatever topic they want to learn. Right? You don't need to have somebody physically standing in front of you in a classroom in order to receive passive learning. So universities that just provide passive learning are providing less and less of a commodity, right, to their students. They can go online and get it. Why the hell should they pay you and go sit in a classroom? So if you're going to bring students into the classroom, you've got to do stuff with them. It has to be practical. We've actually been doing a lot of this at Yale and a lot of this, you know, where I teach as well. You know, shifting into more of an active learning program because students just don't want to sit there. Also, the generation, the younger generation, they do not want to sit in a classroom and listen to lectures. They just don't want to do that. They want to consume passively online. They want to do that. They'll just say, I'll just listen to the podcast later, or I'll just, you know, read it online. I'm not going to sit in a classroom.
That troubles me.
Why?
That really bothers me.
Why?
Because, and this is just anecdotal, but I don't like the idea that they would do that and lose all the socialization.
Well, they're saying that you still go to class, but while you're in class, you do the active learning.
Okay.
Don't bring them into class just to do what they could get online.
Yeah, right. I mean, when I was teaching at the university level, I mean, I started as kind of a TA, and then after I got my master's, I became kind of an adjunct.
Yeah.
And by that point, I was able to teach lecture. But prior to that, when I was a TA, I taught the lab accompaniment to the biology courses. So kids would go and sit through the boring lecture and be really confused, and then they would come to lab, and we would integrate everything that they learned and be like, oh, no, this is what it physically looks like when you do that experiment. So I definitely think that a lot of universities are on their way to do that, but they still stick with this old school, you know, the kind of old, you know, erudite professor stands up and lectures to a large hall.
Yes.
And then the young kind of grad students who don't know how to teach are the ones doing the lab.
But let me bring up my final point, then we'll move on about that, is that other commenters have said that the university system is filled with professors who thrived in the passive learning model. Maybe students who didn't do well in that model, they got filtered out. They're not the professors. So there's this almost built-in bias towards passive learning because those are the people who did well and became professors. But anyway, it may take some inertia to really change it over. Yeah. Let's move on. So Evan is going to tell us about this gorgeous fossil. But Carrie, you have to show people your tattoo.
It's not the same, but
it's not
close.
The same. It's actually my she has my favorite fossil tattooed on her arm.
I know. Archaeopteryx lithographica, specifically the Berlin specimen.
Your tattoo is already paying dividends, Kara. I can't believe this. Totally new species of dinosaur uncovered in China, of all places, named Zhenhuanlong, and paper by the University of Edinburgh and the Chinese Academy of Geological Sciences. They collaborated in publishing this paper, which appeared in the Journal of Scientific Reports. Zhenhuanlong has feathers, you know, like many other dinosaurs had, but also this one had actual wings. Take a look at those long wings. Yep, now look, not necessarily for flight. In fact, they think not for flight.
Maybe, definitely could not fly.
Maybe for gliding, though, has been suggested, but probably more for thermal protection, displaying more plumage, protecting their eggs are some of the benefits of having more feathers on your wings like that. Fossils estimated to be 125 million years old. Our colorful friend here, his remains measure about 2 meters in length is this creature. This is a cousin of Velociraptor. Thank you, Mike Crichton, for making that a household name nowadays so that everybody knows what Velociraptor is. But what we've seen in the films Jurassic Park as a Velociraptor is really nothing like, well, reality, frankly, because what you saw in Jurassic Park, you had these kind of scaly, you know, dinosaurs more like a T-Rex, but really this is a winged creature. I mean, it's more like a giant turkey.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a real transitional theropod bird, you know, species here. This is like even more that we've been getting more and more feathered dinosaurs, clearly, you know, fleshing out this evolutionary space. But this like really fills in another gap, if you will, really showing this half bird, half dinosaur. I mean, it's just a beautiful, beautiful specimen. Not as far along as Archaeopteryx, because Archaeopteryx could fly. This thing can't fly. So we're just filling in this morphological space. It's so undeniably transitional. But the one sad thing about this, at the same time, stories are coming out about there's a massive fake fossil industry in China.
Oh.
And they're getting increasingly sophisticated. And so not that this is a fake fossil, but, you know, paleontologists have to be really on the alert for this. Because a lot of times, like, and which is the case here, the paleontologists aren't digging up the fossils themselves. They're buying them from professional fossil hunters.
There's professional fossil hunters?
Yeah. Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. Cool job.
Yeah, right?
And they're paying a lot of money for these fossils, and people think, well, okay, so they make up fake ones. You know, and so it's a real problem. And unfortunately, that creates plausible deniability, right, to the creationists. Mm-hmm. Because they say, oh, that's a fake. There's a lot of fake fossils coming out of China.
Right. Yeah. That's a bummer. But you know what? I think that there's something that would cheer me up thinking about that. Something that I've been wanting to ask for years now. Bob, can we get a quickie?
Oh, okay.
Your first quickie.
Well, you've been wanting to ask Bob that for years.
For years.
I had no idea. Be prepared, though. This is going to be a little quirky. Sorry, that was a lame joke. LHC researchers have announced the discovery of a pentaquark. Now, this is really fascinating. I just love this. Now, just to put this pentaquark into a little context.
Bob, there's five.
Penta, right. So yeah, as the name implies, we're talking about quarks, and we're talking about groups of five. To put this into context, scientists theorized decades ago that the existence of quarks, you have these fractional particles called quarks, and they're bound together by the strong force. You've got, these are all hadrons. Hadrons are collections of quarks. And so you've got baryons that are the particles that, protons, neutrons, pretty much everything we see here, those are the baryons. You've got the mesons, which are just two quarks, a quark and an antiquark. Now we have a pentaquark, and theories have pointed to this for years. You've got the tetraquark, which we really haven't really discovered, not like this guy, but now it looks like the pentaquark may actually be really be here. It's been hinted at for years and years, about 15 years. They said, oh, look, we think we found pentaquark, but they looked at it later and was like, no, the evidence, it's not solid enough. It's too much noise in that signal. But I think they really nailed this one. The comparison they gave was interesting. They said in the past it was like trying to find the silhouette of a particle, but now all the lights are on and they're looking at it from lots of different angles. And in fact, I think their confidence level is at 9 sigma, which is an amazing level. They seem to be really, really, they've really nailed this one, I think. And they're just so confident. And I know it's scientists have been confident in the past, but 9 sigma is impressive. So remember, though, the pentaquark is not a particle. It's a composite particle. You can create many different types of pentaquarks because you've got 6 quarks. You could take any 5 of them and make one of them an antiquark, and then you can mix them up and make lots of different pentaquarks. So it's not one particle, but it's a composite particle. Now we really need to confirm this, of course, but we need to find out about their behavior, how they're bound, and lots of other different things. So stay tuned. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, this is cool. This is actually a huge discovery.
Yes, this has been your Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you, too.
Thanks, Bob.
Almost forgot.
It's good for me. Yeah.
Good point.
Here now at TAM 2015, or TAM 13, with two giants of the skeptical community, metaphorically speaking, of course. James Randi. James, welcome back to the SGU.
Thank you, sir. Very happy to be here.
And Ray Hyman. Ray, welcome back.
Thank you.
So I love doing interviews at the Amazing Meeting because we can do these dual interviews where we get together more than one person. And you two are perfect together because you both have been in this movement for such a long time. You were there at the beginning, basically, of the modern skeptical movement. Tell
Very
us about
true.
That.
Very true. Yes, I don't know. I've forgotten who we met with, but we met in a French restaurant. I've forgotten exactly who was there. L. Vosburgh Lyons. Mm-hmm. Did you ever know him?
No.
Oh, this one of the strangest guys ever. He was a lawyer. That made him pretty strange to start with. But L. Vosburgh Lyons was a very peculiar cat. Martin Gardner was there and a few other luminaries. And we sat and we had lunch and we talked and we came. And then first of all, they asked me if I wanted to lead it because I was on TV all the time at that part of my career. I said, no, we have to have an academic. And it was a wise decision in the long run. We finally got Paul Kurtz, of course, rather quickly and very, very willingly, of course. And that proved to be the right decision because Paul served us, served the cause of skepticism very well for many, many years, of course.
Right. So it was you, Martin Gardner, Paul Kurtz, and Ray, you were involved early on as well.
Well, as I told last night, actually before that, Randi and I got together when he was traveling with Alice Cooper, May 1973.
Alice Cooper wasn't included in the plan.
He wasn't one of the original skeptics?
What's that?
Alice Cooper.
But Randi called me he was in Portland when they was on the tour, that great tour of Alice Cooper.
Oh, yes.
And Randi was the mad doctor who decapitated Alice Cooper at the end of the show.
In a nice way, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. And I got a call from, I'm so far out of modern culture that when Randi called me in May 1973 and asked me, he said he'd been talking with Alice Cooper, and Cooper was concerned about the makeup of his audience. He had kids who were young teenagers, and he had the college kids, but he didn't have the high school kids. And Randi said, had convinced him that if he talks to me, somehow he can solve the problem. But actually, that was an excuse to get me up there, apparently. I learned that Alice Cooper, right away after he introduced me, was a man. I thought it was a she. Yeah. But mainly, Randi wanted to talk to me about Uri Geller and how we got to do something about him.
Yeah.
And at that point, Randi proposed that we start an organization. He called it SIR, remember?
Yes.
S-I-R, because SRI was where they, Stanford Research Institute, was where they were studying Uri Geller. And so he developed this acronym, SIR, Sanity in Research, which is going to be the name of our group. And we, of course, both concluded Martin, because Martin is a mentor sort of to both of us.
Yes.
And that's what we were for 3 years. That group was called SIR, and it was Randi, Martin Gardner, and myself. And then you remember somehow Tootsie joined us. He heard about us.
Yes, my daughter Tootsie.
He was sort of the link, though. But in 1976, Tootsie met Kurtz in an elevator somewhere. I don't know how it happened. And they decided to join forces, and Tootsie said he can bring Martin Gardner, Ray Hyman, and Randy with him. So we didn't know about it until it happened, and then we went to that organizational meeting, and that's when we started PsyCop.
Mm-hmm. What did you guys think of each other in the first, you know, meeting in the first, you know, 6 months to a year? What did you think about each other? Did you have, what were
about
your first?
Randy?
Yeah.
I was in awe of Randy, you know?
Wow. I didn't know that. If had I known that, my behavior would have been totally different.
Of course, I always thought greatly of Randy.
Yeah. But Randy, what did you think of Ray?
Oh, no, he was very amenable to suggestions and everything, and he knew what he was talking about. And finding a guy...
So a good minion is what you're saying, right? It sounds like you're describing a good minion.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, a good minion and also an unusual occurrence, because yeah. I had spoken to so many scientists who had a suspicion, well, you know, ESP is not all that logical and such. And I couldn't argue with them because I was a mere magician, you see, without any considerable education. And I didn't want to start talking probabilities and permutations and such with them. But when I met with Ray, well, we clinched our association immediately. It was just great. Yeah, very close.
Did you guys have any idea that you were starting, really starting a movement?
Well, I had hopes of it. I had hopes of it. That's why I suggested that I should not be the figurehead. Mm-hmm. See, there, I wanted it to be serious. I thought it should be. And as I say, we eventually got Paul Kurtz as an academic, and he served us very, very well. And I sort of had hopes yeah. of it. Yeah, just way in the back of the skull here someplace. Yeah.
Now, did you do you remember the first time you met Carl Sagan, and you know what was that about?
That's a good question. I don't remember when I first met Carl. I remember I had lunch with him and his first wife in a French restaurant. Another French restaurant,
all right.
Of course.
Guess yes. You like French
food. Oh yeah. No, there are only two in New York. But Carl was a little concerned. I think he felt a little strange that. I would be such a prominent member of such a committee, mm-hmm. you know, because I didn't have any academic standing. He was a little stiff on his attitude about academics, and he didn't quite understand why a magician would be of any use.
You know those academics, I mean.
Yeah. What do they know?
Well, I mean, that situation persists, I think, in the skeptical movement in that we have academics and lay people and philosophers and magicians and activists working together. I think there's still sometimes a little tension there, and I think that it's kind of difficult to know how best to organize mm-hmm. the movement when it's so diverse. Have you think that that kind of tension has persisted in the last 30, 40
years? Well, perhaps, but I think it's a very interesting and productive tension yeah. at the same time. Because we have different views on matters that come up, and there's a certain amount of disagreement and arguments and whatnot, but that's very healthy.
Yeah, but I think what it gets to also, I think maybe this is the first I'm hearing that Carl Sagan had was being an academic purist, is what you're saying, sort of at the beginning.
To a certain extent,
is that
yeah.
nobody knows what a skeptical movement means or what it is because it doesn't fit into. You were inventing a new thing.
Yeah.
It didn't fit into any pre-existing mold. It wasn't an academic institution. It wasn't a professional organization. Yeah. It wasn't purely an activist organization. And it was this new thing, this combination of seemingly disparate elements that were woven together with a common philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we still are struggling a little bit to know exactly
yes,
what we are.
That's true. But it was a new concept
yeah.
altogether.
Yeah.
And I found it quite invigorating. Because it hadn't existed before.
Mm-hmm.
It really, the notion was unknown.
Plus, I think the conception of or the contribution a magician could make to the skeptical community has evolved. That was very early, but now I think it's clear to all skeptics that magicians are uniquely qualified to spot fakes.
Not by any means.
Okay.
But only magicians who have a skeptical attitude.
Skeptical magicians.
Oh, yeah, and I have had a great deal of opposition from the... Well, the magicians' guilds and whatnot, mm-hmm. you know, the Society of American Magicians, the International Brotherhood of Magicians, and these various organizations that think that I shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. Oh, Larry Geller is one of us. No, he is not one of us. Yeah. He's an outright fraud.
Yeah. Wow. And that was like a new concept when you said that.
Yes, it was indeed. And I still get a lot of opposition from the magic fraternity. Mm-hmm.
So this question is for both of you. So how many years has it been since you started? 40 years now.
When
guys started the first meeting.
May 1973 is when it all beginning, and this was a guy who said, let's have a movement. Without him, Geller being the catalyst, of course, without him, there'd be no movement.
So 42 years.
That's the way I see it. That's the way I was there, and then Martin Gardner and Randy, we had meetings, and we did something that PSYCHOP never did, and I think that's why PSYCHOP got in a lot of trouble. We spent a whole day. Remember the first in Martin's house when you were typing your book too on the typewriter? He's the only guy in the world that can multitask. Mm-hmm. Psychologists know you can't be done, but he did it. Yeah. He was typing his book while we were organizing this new group at Martin's house. It was Martin Gardner and Randy and myself. And we spent a whole day, unfortunately I have all the notes preserved, we spent a whole day working out what should be our objectives. Also, even trying to separate out is our main function to be a resource? Is it to be, educational? Yeah. Should we be trying to persuade or even, proselytize? And we try to separate everything and we try to set everything up before we got, and also who should be a skeptic? Right. What qualities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the qualifications?
Then when we got together with Paul Kurtz, he's an organizer, and that's maybe why we got going. He didn't want to have to deal with any of that. He very kindly could listen to me, and I know he wasn't going to pay attention. Then he'd go ahead with just doing the things that you need to organize, stamps and envelopes and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
but he had no interest in clarifying what our goals are and who should be a skeptic, who's not. And as a result, very first year after we organized as PSYCHOP, we had all kinds of problems. And to me, my whole life as a skeptic, beginning at age 7, was outwardly organized, outwardly focused, just as all skeptics are, to focus on the people outside of us who are believing these crazy things or making these crazy claims. But since PSYCHOP began, I became more and more focused internally on who we are, because the biggest problems we were having, the fires we were putting out, caused by fellow skeptics. Anyone could call themselves a skeptic.
Right.
We had people who were actually beating up on other people who were, because of their beliefs, getting other people fired, and they were making all kinds of problems for us, even lawsuits.
Yeah. Mm.
So I have been focused, that's why I started my skeptical's toolbox, to help provide skeptics with some sort of tools that they can use to be better skeptics.
Do you have a standout memory in the past 42 years that you thought was a pivotal moment or that was the most meaningful to you because of the beginning of this journey? You know, what can you remember that was a turning point either for the movement or for you personally?
Well, when Martin Gardner came aboard, of course, things looked up considerably. To have a genius like this on our side and working with us, of course, you know how shy he was. That was one of the problems. We had to go to Martin and ask that. In between, then we had to convert it into something we could tell the newspapers about, the media in general. But that was a huge turning point for us to bring Martin aboard.
How about you, Ray?
I'll tell you one thing. To me, the most hurt I had was when Randy left us and fortunately began a good organization on his own. But when he left us, that was a blow to me.
Yeah.
That hurt me.
Ray, so you said that you spent a lot of time thinking about the goals of the skeptical movement.
Right.
How has your thoughts and feelings on that evolved over 42 years then? So what do you feel today? What should our goals be?
Okay. You know, I had to think about this recently because at one conference recently, they said, you're the grand old man of skepticism. And in other words, I got one foot in the grave now, apparently. Come and tell us your last thoughts.
That was following
on the heels. The Western Psychological Association has a program they call the Last Lecture Series, And about a year ago, a little over a year ago, they invited me to be the person who gives his last lectures, as if this is the last thing you're going to say, and leaving the take-home message in 30 minutes, not 30 seconds.
A little presumptuous, but yeah.
Okay, so I've been thinking about that. This forced me to think about that. And my message, my big message, is that something that's very obvious to psychologists, but actually for the first 7 years of psychology, psychologists denied that. And that is that every impact we have with the environment involves not just what's coming in, but we have what we bring to it, what we project onto it. It's always a contribution of the observer and the environment. Very obvious, but once you spell that out, you realize that no two people are going to interpret the thing the same way. You also know why very smart people, and I've written books on that, very smart people can be so stupid. Mm-hmm. It's not because they lack intelligence or capacity. Remember, intelligence is a capacity. Intelligence tests don't tell us what people will do. It tells us what they are potentially able to do. Mm-hmm. It's what they do, what their tendencies are, how they're going to use what they have or don't use it, that make the difference. And this explains, in a nutshell, why very intelligent people can do very stupid things.
Mm-hmm. I think something might be interesting to handle, too, is, it's important to me personally that this be known, the reason that I left Psychop. Mm-hmm. And that was because of a direct challenge from Paul Kurtz. Mm-hmm. I'd been coming out against Terry Geller, and Paul was sort of lukewarm. Well, he was active in that, too, but lukewarm in some aspects of it. He didn't want it to be so open and so direct. And at one point he said, yes, Uri Geller has threatened to sue us, and so, Randy, you've got to agree never to mention his name again. Mm. And the blow, because he was a major enemy at that time. It certainly is not now, but he was at that time. And I simply had to do a dramatic thing, take the pen out of my pocket, stick it on the table and walk out, and I never went back. And I had to found my organization at that time. But that was a terrible blow to me.
Mm-hmm. And so it was hard for you as well to leave.
Oh, very, very hard. You have no idea. But that was an ultimatum, and Paul was adamant on it. Yeah, never mention Uri Geller again because he'll sue us. That's running in fear, right. And I don't do that.
Right. Did you and Paul reconcile at some point later, much
later on?
Oh, yes.
But there was always a little fringe of difference there between the two of us, because I don't know quite why, but Paul held onto it a bit more than I did, certainly. But we repaired our fences.
Okay.
I should say at a TAM, I think it's 2012 or 2013, I forget which, we had a panel on the origin of skepticism that Randy organized, and Randy and I was on, and I think we had Penn and Teller on it too.
Yes.
But we had Paul Kurtz there.
Yeah, I remember that. Mm.
And at the end of the panel, caught Paul Kurtz and everyone else by surprise. Randy gave him an award and gave him a big hug.
Yeah,
it was a very unusual situation. I never thought it happened.
I remember that as well. And as I say, I am big on hugs because I think they really mean something.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
They mean something more than a handshake.
Absolutely.
And I've shared a lot of them at this meeting, as you've seen.
I'd like to know when Isaac Asimov had a role to sort of play in all this and how he was brought into the movement.
Well, we had the category of scientific consultants. So Sagan and Asimov and several other people like that were sympathetic. You know, almost every scientist we approached, were sympathetic to us. And they didn't want to they didn't play a role in terms of being on the executive council or any active role, but they were willing to support us in any way they could. They're all admirers of Randy, and so we had no trouble. We told them that we've got Randy and Martin Gardner on our side. We could get anyone we wanted.
Do you guys have any single biggest achievement, something that you did during the past 43 years that you think was the most significant?
Well, you pop-off certainly would be a big one, right?
The pop-off episode.
And Geller. I think you did a pretty good job with the magic of Uri Geller and then on with other things you did. He and I'm going to bring that up also. You brought up the issue of academics versus magicians and so on. right at the beginning, you may not remember, right at the beginning of when we got started, Sir, as you call it, you started, it's your idea basically. I just went along with it. We had a discussion about the fact that I'm an academic and my audiences for the most part are other academics. And so I have the luxury of using logic and talking with scientific terms and being muted the way I handle it. Whereas Randy said he's in the fighting, he's in the trenches. Mm-hmm. He's mm-hmm. got to fight fire with fire. Yeah. And so he was very conscientiously going after these people in the way that would attract the public. And to me and my colleagues in the academic world, this idea of the $1 million challenge, even this kind of thing, is too much of bread and games and circus, you know. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues, not anymore. They, if Randy's doing it, they're pretty pleased with it. But it turns out that the public in general, this is what the only thing is going to convince them, put up or shut up. And that's what Randy's doing.
Yeah, right.
And he's conscious. He's aware of this. He's a better psychologist than many psychologists are. And he understands the public mind. And among my colleagues, no way. They've got to be more muted and, you know.
Well, the Popoff matter was certainly a major victory for the amazing meeting.
That was a home run. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was a home run, except that he's still in business.
Well, he's
now. But at a much reduced level, of course.
Sure.
And it hadn't been for the cooperation of Johnny Carson.
Yes, of course.
We used to have little chats before the airings and after the programs and whatnot. And Johnny always said, I saw Popoff on TV again. He's still busy. And I would say to him, John, yes, but they're unsinkable rubber ducks.
Yeah.
Because the people at home will, they want so much the fantasy of angels and devils and the, all that. What did Penn Teller say? You know the word. I won't mention it. I thought that the Popoff thing would be, frankly, much more effective. I thought he would really vanish off the map. But he held on somehow and went to another network, and he's still in business. So. But that's the way it is.
He's selling magic water of some sort.
Yeah,
lately.
Water from Chernobyl.
Well,
because every Christian in Chernobyl lived, you know.
I see.
Randy, at that moment, when you guys were probably out in the parking lot, I think, when you found his frequency and you heard his wife's voice for the first time, like what was happening at that moment when you realize, oh, my God, we found it. We got him. Yeah. What was happening?
Well, that was done by Alec Jason, who was our technician. And when Alec came to me and played that bit of tape, I remember I was saying, there's got to be the end of faith healing, let alone Peter Popoff. It wasn't, of course. But, that was a great sound. Hello, Petey. Can you hear me? This is your wife. If you can't hear me, you're in trouble. Oh,
you knew you had it. You knew you had the whole thing right then.
Bingo. That was it.
First and foremost, as a fellow skeptic and as someone who's here because of the two of you, I want to thank you at the bottom of my heart for doing what you did all these past years. And, you know, we're part of the same community, and we can only thank you for the work that you did to set things up so we could be here and continue on.
Yes, thank you guys.
Thank you. Thank you so much, all of you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Well, everyone, it is time for Science or Fiction. Will Daniel make his way to the stage, please, while I introduce the segment? So we have a guest who's going to be joining us on the stage right in the open chair. Daniel won the auction for this slot last night at the SGU dinner.
Congratulations.
All right, Kara, this starts your stats. You're at 0, 0, 0. So
all right.
This is for everything. You could be at 100% or 0% after today. Daniel, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Thanks again for your generosity towards the SGU and for joining us on stage. So let's read the three items. We're going to read the three items. I'm going to poll the audience very quickly. We'll get the expert opinions of our panel. We'll do another quick poll, and then we'll do the reveal. All right, so item number one, scientists have used metamaterials to create a prototype perfect lens 1,000 times smaller than conventional lenses with the same magnification. Item number two, researchers have developed a light metal foam alloy that blocks gamma rays better than solid steel and X-rays almost as well as lead. And item number three, researchers have used nanowires to increase the yield of a solar fuel cell tenfold using 10,000 times less precious metal or material. So you may notice the theme here is that this is all about material science. These are all just recent news items that happen to have that common theme. Okay, so the way it works, two of these are real, one of these are fiction. If you think of the first one about the perfect, we're going to do the single clap, George Hopp style, right? So if you think that the first one about the perfect lens is the fiction, clap now. Great. If you think the one about the metal foam blocking gamma rays and X-rays is the fiction, clap now. And if you think the one about the solar fuel cell is the fiction, clap now. All right, so I think I noticed a definite preference for the third one, for the solar fuel cell. One and two about equal. Daniel, you are our guest. We're going to start with you.
Okay. Well, for the first one...
By the way, don't say if you have absolute knowledge about... Don't say I read this news item. Yeah, just want to be...
I have no absolute knowledge about any of these.
And if you know when I'm going to die, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
You're sure you don't want to know?
I'm positive.
Okay.
All right, tell me, goddammit.
Scientists have used metamaterials to create a prototype perfect lens 1,000 times smaller than conventional lenses with the same magnification. That's plausible. Man, somebody's going to immediately find a way to use that in cell phone cameras because I know that that's been a frustration of cell phone manufacturers for a long time. The researchers have developed a light metal foam alloy that blocks gamma rays better than solid steel and X-rays, almost as well as lead. I don't know about blocking gamma rays. There's something about that that just sets a bell off in my head. That stands out to me like a sore thumb. Researchers used nanowires to increase the yield of a solar cell tenfold using 10,000 times less precious material. Yeah, tenfold, that doesn't scare me. So I'm going to guess number two because gamma rays is driving me nuts here.
The metal foam alloy. Okay, Kara?
I feel like that's a really good point that I'm just going to completely ignore. You're probably right. You're probably right.
Probably not right. You're,
but one of my best friends is an optical engineer at JPL, and I feel like if number one were true, I might have heard about it from her. I could be wrong. Maybe she doesn't know either. Maybe she's afraid this will screw up her latest experiments. I'm not sure. But I feel like I might have heard about it, so I'm going to go with number one.
The perfect lens.
The perfect lens. And what's a metamaterial? I don't know. So I'm just confused about number one in general.
All right, Jay?
I'm going to say that the second one about the foam blocking X-rays is the fake simply because, and I know I'm not an expert, of course, but the fact that it's foam, which means that there's a lot of zero space in there, that means that the radiation is not hitting anything. Mm-hmm. So the foam is less dense. I don't think that one's real.
All right, Bob?
Yeah, the metamaterials can do amazing things. I'm not surprised they could pull that off, possibly. The nanowires, solar fuel cells, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I'm going with the guys that the gamma ray thing doesn't make sense. If it's a light metal foam, there's just less material there, less open spaces. Doesn't make that much sense.
And Evan?
Light metal foam's got to be the fiction for a lot of the reasons that I think Jay said.
Jeez, it's not looking good for me right now.
You're by yourself.
Welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
You could be by yourself very good. All the other people on the panel think that the gamma rays is the fiction. Let's go to the audience very quickly again. If you think perfect lens is the fiction, clap. If you think that the metal foam is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the solar fuel cell is the fiction, clap. Ooh, all right, so ooh. Still the audience goes for the solar cells.
A little bit.
You did convince some people to move over to the foam. So let's start with...
one.
No, we'll start with three. We'll go backwards. Researchers have used nanowires to increase the yield of a solar fuel cell tenfold using 10,000 times less precious metal. The audience, the majority of the audience thinks that this one is the fiction. Everyone on the panel thinks that this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
Yeah, you should have listened to the panel.
For the other fiction.
Or maybe not. We'll see. So yeah, so solar fuel cell means that it's using solar energy to extract hydrogen and oxygen from water, right? It's not generating electricity directly. It's a way of storing the energy from the sunlight as a fuel. Hydrogen is a fuel, and because you could burn it back with the oxygen
and then use that for the energy. And if we could do that really efficiently, it would be a great source of energy and energy storage. You know,
sure.
Then the coming of the hydrogen economy, right?
Finally.
We may see that eventually after all, if this kind of application comes to pass. So part of the problems in the past has been that, you know, you have to use a gallium phosphide, and it's not cheap, and they have to use a lot of it. So the real innovation here, I mean, there's two simultaneous innovations, but using nanowires, you use a lot less, 10,000 times less gallium phosphide. So that just makes it more practical, you know, for this to be an application. And at the same time, tenfold increase in the actual amount of hydrogen that you make from the sunlight. So that is, I don't think we're there yet. I'm not saying we're there yet, but this is a pretty exciting advance. Again, there's a lot of possibilities for this type of technology. This may not be the one that hits eventually, but you know, this is pretty encouraging. All right, let's go to number two. Researchers have developed a light metal foam alloy that blocks gamma rays better than solid steel and X-rays almost as well as lead. The gentleman on the panel think this one is the fiction carrier all by yourself.
Although I did say he's probably right.
Thank you.
I did qualify.
Don't even start with that. You think this one is science. You're alone up here thinking that, and this one is science.
Ooh, Kara.
Oh, yeah. Right here. See? The cam did not lie.
Yes.
It said superstar. Kara, nice. You're a superstar.
Well,
clearly.
I'm
Thank
actually
you.
Pissed off.
100%, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, you're right. What you're saying intuitively makes sense, but what the researchers found. So they made it's an alloy using tungsten. It's called high-Z steel. Or is it maybe high-Z steel, or whatever. So this is done by North Carolina State University. They tested some of this foam metal alloy, and they found that, yeah, it blocks gamma rays better than if it were solid steel.
So
it's
the mechanism.
This is great for space.
This
is absolutely perfect
it's
for space fantastic. Exploration.
What's the mechanism? How does it work?
Well, it's just the material itself. It's just the foam is better at blocking gamma rays even than if it were solid. So the other thing is that they said for X-rays, it's not quite as good as lead, but it's getting there. And the researchers are confident that when they, you know, they're still researching this, they'll be able to get it to the point where it's actually even better than lead. And of course, it's much lighter. So it's the amount of radiation you're blocking for the amount of weight that you have.
Right.
So this is good for not just space travel, but also like X-ray machines or any technology where there's radiation involved. Or nuclear, you know, factories or nuclear power plants, et cetera. So any place where there's radiation, this could be really optimal, lightweight, structural shielding. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. Very good. Which means that scientists have used metamaterials to create a prototype perfect lens, 1,000 times smaller than conventional lenses with the same magnification. That one is the fiction.
But it's a metamaterial. They can do anything.
I know. So they are researching this, Bob. They are, but they haven't made a prototype. They're nowhere near making a prototype. This is Michigan Technological University. They just did an experiment where they showed that the problem with using metamaterials as a lens is that it blocks the light. So obviously it doesn't make a very good lens if the light can't make it through. So what they figured out is that if they send a light of a certain frequency through, they call that the sacrificial light wave, that gets blocked and allows the other light through. So this just makes it possible for them to develop a perfect lens, but they haven't done it yet. They don't have a prototype. They're a long way away from that. So I think you're right, Kara. You probably would have heard about it. Congratulations.
Yay. Good job, Kara.
Congratulations.
Good job.
Yeah.
The real good news, I think the best news about all of this right now is that now Kara is in the lead and Jay is no longer in the lead. That's awesome. Wait, that puts me in third place. Crap. Oh, well.
She's one show away, Bob, from being. Don't worry, it'll happen.
All right. So very quickly, we're running out of time, so we want to thank everybody we have to thank. Thanks to Chip. Thanks to the J-Rep. Thanks for George for being awesome, of course. We have to thank our families who put up with so much crap all year long. All the work that we have to do, our wonderful wives who help us. They're manning the table back there. My daughters are here with us, too. They're also manning the table.
Phil Hudson.
Phil Hudson is with us filming. Who else? There's too many people we can't remember. But thanks to everyone who helps us do all the things that we do. And, Evan, you're going to close us out with a quote.
It's okay to fool people as long as you're doing that to teach them a lesson. which will better their knowledge about how the real world works. No matter how smart or well-educated you are, you can be deceived. James Randi from the film An Honest Liar. Available on Netflix. You have no excuse to not see it.
Thank you all for joining me this week on the SGU. Thanks again to the JRIF and to the amazing meeting. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.